And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
Alright, kiddies. We've got a ball buster of a show today. It's Phantasm 2! Almost all the crew is back, sort of, but this time with 300% more balls. And infinitely more chainsaws. It's one of those rare horror movies where both the hero and the villain have male pattern baldness. Enjoy!
Hello, and welcome back to the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror. I'm Chris Honeywell, and I'm here with the usual crew of miscreants. We've got Luke, Jack, and Eddie.
Oh, man, my head really hurts. I don't know. I think I got something stuck in it.
Chris Tyler?
I have nothing to offer on this because I couldn't think of anything in time.
Oh, Sean Engel, you've had some extra time.
Yep. Man, Jawas are fucking nasty.
Oh, wait. I got one. You play a good game, Luke.
Yeah, some Jawas go bad in this movie.
That's worse than, like, the mayonnaise goes bad, let me tell you.
Well, I haven't seen this one in a long time, and it's Phantasm 2. And as you remember from the last movie, I'm a huge Phantasm fan. I saw this before, and I remember liking it, but not as much as Phantasm. And I'm sort of in the same place, but I think I liked it a lot more this time. I think I had a lot more fun watching it this time.
This one is just a hoot.
Yeah, it's actually Phantasm 2, The Tall Man.
Is it?
Is that the subtitle? I never knew it had
a subtitle. I've never known it to have a subtitle.
That's what I saw in when I accessed this movie.
Well, okay. I've never known that because I've only ever known it as Phantasm 2 and being
Electric Boogaloo.
Electric Boogaloo! And growing up in the 80s, this was the first Phantasm I had ever heard of, and the first
Ditto.
Phantasm I'd ever seen.
Ditto.
So, to me, this one, I know this one a lot more than I know the original Phantasm, but it had still been a number of years since I had watched this, and it was fun to get back into this one again. It's definitely an 80s movie, you know? And being an 80s guy, I'm on board with that.
Well, that Franken mullet on the female lead in the first shot of her is just proof that it's 80s.
The Franken mullet and then her outfit, you know, with the pale jean or the light jean pants.
The school marm outfit. That's what I call it, the 80s school padded shoulder school marm outfit.
And the scarf. The scarf always a nice touch.
Buttoned up, everything buttoned up to the neck with a sweater over it.
Well, she's the good girl.
Yeah.
See, I remember actually going to a convention. You know, this came out right as I was starting into college. I'm going to a convention, a local convention here, and it was a Star Trek convention. We had some characters from the show. I think James Doohan showed up, and they were giving out buttons there. And this is the first time I heard about this movie coming out, because I remember watching Phantasm left and right when it was playing back in the 70s and 80s on HBO and just loving the heck out of this. And I think a subtitle that I saw for it, at least this was on one of the pins they gave out, was Phantasm 2, The Ball is Back. Which I was like, I didn't get a chance to see it because I think it came and went in theaters and I never got a chance to see it. But I was really stoked for this because I thought a Phantasm movie, you know, X number of years. And it looks like they got most of the crew back and Don Coscarelli was directing again. And it was an enjoyable movie.
Well, not only is the ball back, but we find out that the tall man has three balls.
No.
Oh, testies, Polly testies. Orchid, you joke.
One, two, three? but, you know, the thing, again, and having, as I said, Yeah, the ball is back. I remember that was what the ad campaign said and all that. And you get this gist at, oh, okay, that this Phantasm movie must be about this tall guy who has balls that he kills people with. And it's like, no, not even close. No. Not even close. You're in the ballpark, but that's about it. And I remember the first time I saw this being so confused because it literally picks up immediately upon the ending.
Right at it, yeah.
Of the original, and it's like, what the hell is going on? I don't know what's going on here. But I gotta say, Kestra does a real good job of matching it up. You know, they hide young Mike's face, so we don't see it in the new shot stuff. Reg looks great. They match the. I mean, it's clearly his house or somebody's house. I love the drawers in the kitchen just filled with crap. Yeah, it's like, that's no set decoration. That's that kind of pack ratnish can only come from somebody's
house. Yeah.
was any of that filmed during the production for the first one?
I don't think
so. Because it looks like.
It's lit like the first. There's a definite difference in lighting from the two movies. The second one is definitely more. It's lit better, but I don't like the. It's not as moodily lit. And I think they used some footage from the first movie, but man, they matched it pretty. When you had the new footage of, you know, like, okay, Mike was pulled through the mirror, but the dwarves are just like. Hauling him out of the closet afterwards, that matches up almost perfectly. The only part that I thought where I was like, okay, that doesn't look, you know, that's definitely not Mike, was, you know, in the jump through the window where it was obviously a stunt person in a wig.
Yeah.
You know, but, yeah.
Well, I do have to say, I do love that he kicks the dwarf down the stairs and he suddenly turns into a full grown guy. That's somehow, I don't know how that works. Well, he kicked him so hard his legs just stretched right out from underneath.
Popped right out, yeah.
It was something about the differentiation of the gravity between here and the universe they're in. That's
I totally can believe that.
Right at the beginning I was just like, oh yeah, that's right. They definitely and this sort of goes back to the last Friday the 13th, the Jason Goes to Hell that we talked about. There's definitely a post Evil Dead 2 feel to this.
Oh yeah. Well, the camera till the third one.
What's that?
Wait till the third one.
Yeah. I mean from that scene where he's going through the drawers and the camera's like pulling back just ahead of him, you know, it's very kinetic, very Sam Raimi like. Yeah. And as I don't know if you guys noticed, but when the guy in the crematorium is dumping the ashes in that one bag. The bag says Sam Raimi on it.
Mr. Sam Raimi delivered in brass.
Which is a double. It's a great double joke because it's ash too.
Oh, there you go. See, there were a couple little Easter eggs that I caught in this film. Another one that I found out, and I'm not certain it had to come out because RoboCop was out this time. One of the I think when they went up to one of the grave sites in the cemetery scene, there was the name of Alex Murphy on one of the tombstones.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Obviously, Alex Murphy is, you know, the guy who became RoboCop. So I'm wondering if, you know, Coscarelli was sort of homaging Verhoeven as well as Sam Raimi.
My note for that is, oh, they look at the grave of Alex Murphy. It's like, well, of course it's empty.
Right?
Yeah. RoboCop.
He's stalking around, you know, Delta City right now.
The one, if I had any negative about this, and it's a very minor one, it didn't seem to further the idea of what's going on. The first movie had this really surreal type feel that you didn't exactly know what's going on. You didn't quite get that, and you didn't quite get any further development of who the tall man is, what's going on with these weird, creepy Jawas. I know that's going to come along in the later movies.
It does come along.
It just sort of feels like a
continuation. It was just going on with the freewheeling sort of, you know.
It felt more like a, you know, like, I hate to, the only thing that's coming to mind is like, you know, Master Ninja, you know, people going from town to town trying to figure out and find out what's going on and take down this tall man, but it's not really developing the character of the tall man all that much. So that was the only real disappointment about this. Otherwise, the movie was just a heck of a lot of fun. You know, I I want to see more of the balls, slapped against guys' heads. It does not get
boring for a second. There's not a boring second in this movie, that's for sure. No. They blow up two houses in this movie.
Two houses and the car.
Yeah, the car.
Yeah. And the Cuda.
And is it? And here's the thing I was thinking. Now, I'm watching this movie again, and I hadn't seen this for a number of years. You got two dudes that are essentially amateurs with their own gear driving around the country in a souped-up muscle car. It's supernatural, isn't it? Essentially? I mean, and this guy's and Reg is the surrogate older brother for Mike, so they're sort of like brothers, you know? We're brothers, as E. Honda would say. And all I've got to say is they go into the hardware store, and they take the shotguns, and he makes the four-barreled shotgun. As an old-school Luke Cage Hero for Hire fan, all I can think of is Cockroach Hamilton and his six-barreled shotgun named Josh. And that's as close as we're going to get to seeing Josh on the big screen. Awesome.
They just cast Luke Cage, man.
And let me tell you something, Hero. If Cockroach Hamilton ends up in the Luke Cage Netflix series, I will, I don't know. I'll do something really, really humiliating
to
myself.
Will you eat a cockroach?
I will, in fact, eat a cockroach if Cockroach Hamilton shows up.
Wow.
Rocket Raccoon, that's all I got to say.
Let me tell you something. Rocket Raccoon is a lot more popular than Cockroach Hamilton, even before that movie. Thanks for playing. Anyway, but that and then the makeshift blowtorch flamethrower deal.
Yeah.
Very Evil Dead like. Oh, yeah. And that's what I like about it. Irresponsible use of weaponry and technology. They're not squeamish about, that we need guns, we'll break into the. And I was like, oh, they're breaking and entering the store. Oh, well, they would do that. And then I'm like, oh, Reg left some money. Okay, they made a point to. I loved Reg in this movie. I love Reg in the first movie, but I was kind of making fun of his bad acting. But in this one, he does a good job of being the sort of balding surrogate Bruce Campbell.
Exactly.
But at the same time, he has those moments of that laid-back California guy Reg, where he's just like, "All right, get in the car," He just had that sort of easygoingness that's probably just the way the actor is.
Yeah,
but there's still moments of that in this, just very natural moments with him, alternating with him being an action star and fighting with a chainsaw and stuff,
which was awesome.
I mean, Mike says it all, doesn't he? I'm a 19-year-old kid, and you're a balding middle-aged ex-ice cream vendor. Who are we kidding?
Yeah. I would have taken Reg's girlfriend over Mike's girlfriend in a second.
She was the movie.
She was some. I checked out on this. She was some sort of radio host or some sort of. I think she also played in some sort of softcore Skinamax type movies. I think she was in like the Bear Winch project, which makes sense because, her sex scene with Reg in there was perhaps one of the
ridiculous
sex scenes.
It was hilarious, though.
The exact opposite of our Friday the 13th 9 cowgirl sex scene. This one's like, he's got his jeans on and she's got her underwear on.
Yeah.
You can make it work.
But when you line it all up on screen, I've been watching a lot of grindhouse skinny movies. It doesn't line up. The angle of the
maybe he's just that big that no angle makes a difference.
The angle of attack is all off. The angle of the incident.
Look, maybe all I gotta say.
Hey, maybe it was.
If it's funny, it overrules anything, and that is.
It was funny.
That's fucking hilarious. I mean, she's and the look on Reg's face during the whole thing to self it so much. Yeah. It's like, what the hell is going on?
It's surprised that you're having sex with a crazy person.
Well, it reminds me of a little flashback to the graveyard scene at the beginning of Phantasm 1.
Yeah. And speaking of the graveyards, I do want to say, I absolutely love the set dressing and the whole set design.
Yes.
When you go to that first graveyard.
Yeah.
And all the graves have been dug up because, you think about it. You go to a cemetery, there's different headstones. There's different, there's different types of markers. They're all, not everything is precisely laid out, And it really looks like an actual cemetery that they've dug up all these graves rather than a set. It looks
really creepy. The lighting on it was nice. That was a very dreamlike sequence. That was a very Phantasm dreamlike sequence. there. And a lot of the scenes in the morgue and in the, you know, and around the in the hallways of the mausoleum were very moody and phantasm like too. It was the more straightforward scenes of like in a room and stuff that just had more professional Hollywood lighting to them. Whereas in the first movie, they had just done what they could, and it made it a lot darker, but a lot more moody and almost realistic. Whereas this one, it's like, it's lit like a film, you know, they got everybody's face lit well and everything like that. But that's just a minor quibble.
Well, it's clear from the beginning that this has a larger budget. And in fact, this has the largest budget of all of the Phantasm films. What's funny is that Universal, who released this, they really wanted a horror franchise to compete with Paramount and New Line and everybody else. And so they expressed a lot of interest to Coscarelli to do another Phantasm film. And so they gave him $3 million, which was the lowest budget of any film Universal released that decade. But it still was the highest
budget
film.
For him. Yeah,
for him. Yes, for a Phantasm film. So I think, I got to be honest, to me, it shows up on the screen.
Oh, beyond $3 million. Luckily, he doesn't have any like big star. He has his like crew with him. You know, he's got instead of like huge name stars. So all the budget is right there up in the screen in special effects and action sequences.
Yeah, the practical effects in it are pretty fucking good.
Pretty nice. Yeah, I mean, there's some rubbery Jawa heads and stuff, but they're still actually pretty. The grandma made into a Jawa is pretty effective.
Yeah. And again, you gotta consider also, you know, it's 1988, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the two of the guys that worked is Greg Nicotero and Robert Kurtzman would go on to form K&B, you know, K&B effects. And for a $3 million budget in 1988, the effects in this are to me, on par with a lot of the stuff we'd see over in the Nightmare series at New Line.
Well, from a pure, the first Phantasm, like the first Phantasm, when I first saw it, hit me on a deeper level than I thought it would. But before I saw it, when all my friends who had HBO were describing it and stuff, the focus was the ball being the coolest thing in the world, drills into your head, shoots blood out. So in order to, for that basic, for them to, in the sequel, to get that basic level of getting a 10-year-old kid who sees it on HBO, they definitely succeeded in taking the ball up to the next level.
Yeah.
And that the one sequence with the ball making its way through that one guy's entire body is just wondrous. It's so kinetic, and like when he's spinning around because the ball's inside him, like trying to levitate and spin it, really you can see the physics behind it, however impossible they are. It makes sense within the fact that he has a ball full of spinning blades inside of him.
Yeah.
And the last shot with it just stuck in his cheeks like that was pure right out of the first movie.
Oh yeah. And the balls are just freaking awesome. I do love the sound design for them, where their drill is a dentist drill.
Uh-huh.
Because I think that sound whines in a certain frequency that our minds, oh, you know, we get freaked out by it.
And I like the blade that comes out of it is kind of blunt.
Yeah.
It's just like a sort of screwdriver blade. It just makes it even more horrifying to see that work.
That scene really, to me, doesn't make a lot of sense. It's like, why is the ball, the sphere, suddenly attacking the graver? But at that point, you don't care because it's friggin' awesome.
I think it just goes for meat. Basically, I think that's
a perfectly reasonable explanation.
It just goes for anything that's alive that's out there. So if you get out of its way and there's something else there, it's going to get that. And I think that was another little tribute to Evil Dead was
his hand off.
The guy hacking his hand off, yeah.
And I do love, what happened to the rest of them? I'll tell you later. What's funny is that we said, you had mentioned, you know, the scene of him writhing around. The one that's in the trailers and the one that I think is still really cool is the sphere chasing Mike and Liz through the hallways and just bursting through each door.
Yeah.
it's, you know, they're slamming that door, and it's a disguised cut, but it looks really, really seamless and really good. Of just
the sound design is really helping. Smash. Yeah.
Yeah, sound design.
Again, you might want to think that that's also an homage again to Sam Raimi's Evil Dead 2, because what there is seen there, where we see the sort of evil spirit of the Evil Dead chasing
running
Ash
the house
throughout
and
the
doing
cabin,
the same thing, yeah.
You know, smashing through doors and all that. So
yeah, I think he runs right out of the house and back right around into the house and through it again.
The other reference, since we're making all the notes on all the little homages and references, one I caught, I doubt this is intentional, but the one that I thought of, and I thought it was appropriate for the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror, is when Grandma's in bed and then she turns over and dead Grandpa's there next to her. It's like, hey, Prince of Darkness, right there.
Oh, yeah.
Never covered here on the vault.
I like how he gives her the little eyebrow twitch, too. It's like, hey.
Oh, man. Rigor mortis is set in everywhere.
Nope.
But the thing about rigor mortis is all the blood.
Don't ruin this for
me. Okay.
I mean, it's a perfectly good sex joke, and you ruined it, Sean.
Well,
in other news, I also have to I have to say that I really, really love Reggie's hat that says Boogie Down on it.
Yes.
It's he's such a throwback to the sort of 70s,
that 70s,
you know, almost burnout type characters. You know, one of these people who thinks he's ultimately cool, and he's gonna, you know, once he, you know, gets his song written, he's gonna sell it to you know, Fleetwood Mac, and he's gonna be you know, so well known, and he'll
he lives in someone's guest house somewhere behind their house.
You know, he's such a fun throwback character to see him, you know, kind of have to take on, like you've said, the Bruce Campbell you know, motif is just, it's an enjoyable little,
he does it too, he pulls it off.
Yeah,
it's he's one of the most unusual, like, action, I hesitate to say horror heroes, but like horror action heroes ever, you know.
Yeah. And I love the bit with him and the graver with the chainsaws. Where he pulls out his chainsaw and the other guy pulls out the much, much larger chainsaw. It's like, oh, that's subtle.
That whole sequence is just a blast to watch.
Which TCM is that where they're fighting with the chainsaw? Is that two? Is that two?
I couldn't remember. Dennis if that Hopper. Was two or three. Dennis Hopper and Leatherface.
Right, yeah. Yep. So it's like, but again, it's that whole scene where he's dodging and then he cuts the bandolier off of him.
Yeah, his reaction is priceless. And then he does that amazing leap over the top of it. It's
like with it just like 3 inches below his crotch.
It's just great.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, there's so many. If there's any criticism of the film, I think that would, what it would be is that there's all these great set pieces. But it's kind of just set pieces linked together in a lot of ways. The narrative is fairly pedestrian, but I don't really care that much because the set pieces are really good, and two, the whole kind of narrative is a little dreamy and a little odd because it's Phantasm. That was what the whole point of the first movie was. You know, what's dream, what's not dream,
right?
The surrealism of it, and the surrealism is mostly gone here, but we get some of it where
it's still, you know, weird sense. It's still not taking place in pure reality, because like that ghost town they go into, that's just not,
that can't be real.
Right
Yeah.
or the very beginning where they blow up Reg's house, and then Reg says, oh, that story you told about me blowing up my own house, and it's like, well, did it happen or not? And then we see, of course, that it was, you know, it was all a dream, but it's coming true and all that. So I just think it does, and it just does a lot with what it has. Mm-hmm. And then the effects set pieces are really standout. The one in the mausoleum with the tall man coming out of the simulacrum of Liz, that is friggin' creepy as hell. You know, just coming up out of her spine like that.
Yeah.
It's like, again, would be right at home in one of the sequels to Nightmare on Elm Street, for sure, you know?
Yeah, I love that.
Freddy would have made some kind of a joke, but, you know.
No, but
I'm back! Or something. But
the Yeah, but the tall man does not joke like that.
I like that.
It's awesome.
When he does make one line that's kind of a joke, which is awesome. Hello again. Goodbye.
And goodbye. And but then he just chucks her. That's great.
Yeah, he doesn't fuck around.
There's just little wrinkles added to his person. Just little tiny touches added to his personality. But then again, they were like, they were probably at this point thinking, and they did, we're going to be making more movies.
Yep.
So the only thing that pulled me away from reality, or quote unquote, the reality of the movie, was there was one point where the tall man threw his head back and screamed, and I could see his fillings. I was like, why would the tall man have fillings?
Well,
who's this dentist?
The Spears.
Hold on, you'll
no Novocaine.
You'll understand.
Probably one of those little balls, man. He probably just like.
He doesn't have sentinel spheres in his mouth. He has sentinel fillings.
See, we should make a movie of just the tall man's normal life, where he's like sitting around and there's a little ball like hovering around his head, giving him a haircut, you know, brushing his teeth. A little toothbrush comes, it flies up, a chunk. A little toothbrush comes out.
I just have a picture of one of the dwarves bringing him a drink. I said no ice, you know.
Him coming out of the bathroom just like, woo.
Do not
comes
go
up
in
and
there.
Goes, take care of that. Plunger comes out.
Maybe all this will be answered in the fifth Phantasm movie.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll get to see more of that.
you know, Liz makes a choice at one point in this film where, you know, I understand I'm not a character in a movie. I really do. But if I see a moldering, disgusting old casket with smoke pouring off of it, I'm going to go the other way.
Yeah.
Just putting that out there, you know?
Yeah, but she's psychic, man.
Then she should have seen it coming. Well, that it was a bad idea.
She had to investigate.
Yeah. Oh, but...
This definitely isn't the same actor that played Mike, right?
No, this is James LaGrosse, who's also in Point Break.
Well, I wonder why they didn't get Mike back.
Universal said, you gotta choose. Do you want to have original Reggie or original Mike?
Oh, yeah, really? Well, they made the right choice.
They said, we're putting up the money, you can only have one.
Jeez, original Mike was a good actor, too.
He comes back in the next one, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think he's in the next two films.
Oh, really? So he's back cast as Mike.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
And Jody comes back in the next one as well, if I remember.
Don't say anything, because that's awesome.
Oh, sorry. But I don't even remember if I've seen number three or not. I think I have, but who knows of me. I watched the film this morning, and it was a total flashback to watching this on HBO with my brother and stuff. And what's funny is we always used to joke that the ending was, and here's where they ran out of money, because it ends so suddenly. Again, having not seen Phantasm and not knowing that the ending is a reference to the original, you know, it's like, and we're done. That's it. We have no more film left.
Yeah, that's half the fun of the Phantasm movies. It is. It's like, we're just like, we're putting it all out there for you, and then here's your ending.
It makes me wonder if, besides being the homage to the original and the ending of the first Phantasm, whether this was intended to kill off Mike and Liz and Reg and do sequels with new characters like we were getting with the other franchise horror films of the 80s.
They would at least have the option of doing it, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, surprisingly...
They have the option of doing whatever the hell they want at any point, because how many times has Reg died? He's died a couple times so far, right? And Jody was alive and dead in the last movie all the way through it, you know, at different points.
It's funny, though, because for this series, which is so heavily based on how weird everything is and how much is a dream and how much can you really believe, it's got some of the tightest continuity of any of the horror franchises.
That helps when you've got one dude writing it.
That's the thing about it, is sequels and stuff like in franchise movies, I was always very sketchy about. And my entire relationship with Coscarelli started with seeing Phantasm and like reading an interview with him and being like, oh, wow, this guy puts a lot more thought into his movies than just, you know, making a dumb horror movie. And then sort of doubting it and being like, okay, Phantasm, and then Phantasm 2. And I think before I even saw Phantasm 2, I saw, like, Beastmaster. And yeah. I remember Beastmaster getting pretty much drubbed by the critics, and it was during that the tail end of the sword and sorcery fad of movies, you know, that started with Conan. And so I was like, and it came on HBO, and I remember Scott Gardner and I were watching it at his house, and about 15 minutes into the movie, we were laughing at some of the lines. But, you know, started realizing, oh, yeah, that's right. Coscarelli, even if he is doing cheese, he always puts that extra, those extra levels and layers into it that make it more than just, you know, a movie with a A to B to C plot. You know, he puts a little depth to it or an internal logic to it that works.
In other words, it's kind of more than the sum of its parts, really.
Yeah, and yeah. Watching this, I was watching this, I don't know if Luke and Sean, you've seen John Dies at the End yet. I know Hero you have, because we did the show.
Oh, yeah.
But watching this movie, I was like, oh, I can very... Watching this movie totally makes it seem... I can see how natural it was for him to be the director of John Dies at the End. It was like a perfect match of material and director.
Yeah.
And I think as time has gone on, as movies, I'm really excited to see 3 and 4. I remember seeing little pieces of them on a video. Somebody was playing videos with clips of them at a bar. But it was all out of sequence. It was just special effects sequences and stuff.
See, but, I don't think I've seen 3 and 4 all the way through yet. I know some of what's coming up and the expansion of, you know, what's behind the dwarves, what's behind the tall man, and what's behind the two tuning fork things that lead to the alternate dimension and all that. But I'm looking for... I think we mentioned Coscarelli doing all these films and having a specific idea of what he wanted to do. This is a lot like Sam Raimi, who did his three Evil Dead films and gave it a very cohesive feel.
Oh, yeah.
And, I think the two directors are kind of similar in that.
I'm sure I don't know for a fact, but I'll bet you they're buddies because Sam Raimi took the Hercules movies, Hercules Xena thing. Mm-hmm. That was all Sam Raimi. Producing
sort of.
It. Well, yeah. You know, he was sort of the producer start, you know, right, you know, it was Sam Raimi being like, I'm going to do a little, like, start a TV arm that I can get, you know, Bruce Campbell and some of my friends and stuff so that they have a genre show to work on, you know? And it was very successful. And I think Coscarelli, you know, took that lead with the Beastmaster TV show.
I was going to say, yeah, he did the Beastmaster.
Yeah, I mean, the Beastmaster show is very much like Hercules, you know?
Was the Beastmaster show actually... Did Coscarelli have something to do with actual TV show?
I think he was executive producer of it type thing.
Really?
Because from what I remember, after the first movie, they did a couple of sequels to the Beastmaster, and it starred, you know, it still had what's-his-name from the first movie. But
Mark Singer.
Yes, Mark Singer. But, you know, to various differing degrees, it didn't really fit in.
Yeah,
but
he might have just... I don't think he directed the other ones.
No, but, to know that he did... To know that he had something to do with the TV show is interesting, because I thought the TV show was kind of different from the original movie. So, yeah, that's interesting to hear that Coscarelli was behind it, though.
Yeah, you know, it's... the vibe I'm getting from watching these Phantasm films again is that, you know, he knows, because this whole concept, the whole Phantasm concept, is kind of his baby. He knows it so well that all the internal logic always works, because it's the fan's mentality of, okay, if this happens, then this has to happen because of this, this, and this.
Yes.
He knows all the continuity. It's
and
in his head.
There's continuity, and there's also like emotional themes and sort of things that repeat, you know, like a dream, you know, like Reg dying and people getting pulled through the mirror at the end, and, you know, evil temptresses who ride on top of you and have sex with you and stuff like that. But it's all, you know, I mean, he's still sort of working off that, like, death, and this one takes it a little further. It takes it from right into the morgue, you know, with,
yeah.
And oh man, I can't believe we haven't brought it up yet, though. But the scene with the hydrochloric acid or the sulfuric acid,
yeah, I was gonna make sure
getting injected into the tall man. Oh my god, that blows Raiders of the Lost Ark away as far as helping people go.
So, you know, you mentioned though bringing it into the. I think the term that Cusgrill used was for the first one was kind of the rituals of death.
Yes.
And the rituals of death are on full display here. Like you said, we see the, you know, the in the mortuary and then the crematorium. And it's you know, it's all this stuff looks really believable. I've never been in a mortuary. I've never been inside a crematorium. I don't know if that's how they look, but I'm willing to accept it watching this because it looks really, really real.
I have a feeling it looks really
believable.
They were at a real, because some of the tools, that, like they had that one, that kind of it was like a car jack for corpses to get them up on the table.
The hoist lift.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, they probably filmed around. I mean, it seemed a little too like a little dingy, that dingy clean of a creepy mortuary. I'm sure mortuaries nowadays are more akin to like a hospital type setting.
Or an Apple store.
Yes, yes.
They're all wearing their badges around their neck. Hey, how you doing? Is it your first death? Oh, okay.
But it just...
And then the whole scene in the crematorium, you know, I said ever since I first saw Diamonds Are Forever that I didn't want to be cremated. This film just kind of cemented that for me. It's like, yeah, that seems horrifying. What if I'm actually not dead? I can't deal with that.
And it sort of takes off... I'm sure all you guys have seen Return of the Living Dead.
Oh, yeah.
And there's famously in Return of the Living Dead, there was a scene where the guy, you know, knew he was turning into a zombie. So he just, you know, rolled himself into the oven and burned himself. And he was inside. You heard him, you know, screaming in pain. And the studio people were like, that's too intense. So they turned the music way up so you couldn't hear the guy screaming. And this one made a point.
him
slapping
to the point
hand
where you see him melting. And that melting charred hand that hits the window is really nasty. It's all meaty, you know, charred on the outside, medium rare on the inside.
Yeah, you gotta turn the heat down a little bit.
Yeah,
you're not cooking them evenly.
Yeah. And some nice color on that. Yeah. Nice caramelization going there.
The real trick: only flip them once.
But I like
that. More than that, you're just messing with it.
I like
and the marinade helps.
I like that he had a whole new little hierarchy of minions in this one. You know, you had the gas mask guys, and you had
the gravers.
Yeah, and they have some of the creepier scenes, like in the crematorium, or like you had mentioned, Chris, with the hoist in the embalming area.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a nice, simple costume too. It's a good money-saving costume, and
it's all in their
creepy performance.
Or like when they're at the funeral, and they, you know, the way that they're moving in unison and all that, it's creepy, and it's really simple, but it really is effective and it works. I thought the gravers were a great addition, because really, how are the dwarves going to do all this?
Right.
You know, so it makes sense, not only, again, from a logical standpoint, but then it gives them a chance to have a creepy character that you can then, you know, heap punishment upon in the form of attacking their groin.
Right.
And it's not the tall man getting chainsawed in the nads. It's this, you know, anonymous graver. So it gives you some other evil characters you can have the heroes interact with.
And that scene where the guy's after getting chainsawed in the crotch, it is on the ground. They show the shot of him crumpled on the ground with just blood, like sprayed out from his crotch area. I was like, you know, that was a pretty ballsy sex shot for those days. You know, that was pretty gruesome. It was.
Pissed himself after dying in the first one, though.
That's true.
Yeah.
But the little touches like that are what. And like the scene when they first went to the mortuary and Mike saw the girl on the table and then she was gone. And he interpreted that as, we can't have this girl come along with us. I saw her dead, you know, as she's in danger. Whereas in fact, it was basically telling him that she was with the tall man.
That, well, she was. I saw her dead is correct.
Right.
Because he doesn't interpret it right.
Right.
You can have all the, military. You can have all the intelligence in the world. If it's not actionable, it doesn't do you any good.
Right. And
I thought, again, that was another thing, just really clever. I mean,
you're
expecting a twist because it's a Phantasm movie, but at the same time, you're thinking, well, they've kind of vetted everybody here. They've done the deed. They melted them down. And it's like, it's got to be Kemi at this point because there's no one left to turn on
nobody
them.
Nobody left to get them,
Because after this, they go, check that casket, make sure whatever's in it's actually dead. It's empty. Woo! Rock on, Packers!
Yeah,
and it's so subtle that
we didn't have back in movie days is, and I notice in with especially with movies like this, is when you're playing it on your computer, you've got the little line at the bottom, so you know how many minutes you have left. So when they're like, it's empty, woohoo, and you look down, you're like, oh no, it's not over yet.
Yep.
Whereas in the movie theater, you never knew in those days, which was always better with.
Yeah, there's a bit of surprise. Although, again, it's really, I think it's very subtly handled where Kemi closes the divider.
Yes.
Because after we had already seen her, enthusiasms.
But they already knew that those two were kind of horn dogs, so they were just like, oh, geez, here they go.
And I love also when the cars start swerving around. You know, it's like we see Mike and Liz get in front of. What are they doing back there?
What do you think?
Hey, if you had the opportunity in the back of a hearse, would you pass it up?
No,
hell no.
You would drink for free for the rest of your life on a story like that, my friend.
Oh, yeah. The only thing that would beat that would be a church confessional.
Oh. Yeah. As long as it's not with the priest, right, Hero?
Hey. Low blow.
I'm Catholic too, so I'm right there with you.
All right.
That's a different kind of story.
That's the one that
you have to tell to the district attorney.
That's a whole other podcast.
If it does not fit, you must acquit.
Oh. No. I really enjoyed it, even though it's different in a lot of ways than the first one, but you can really see the connective tissue. You can see obviously Coscarelli's even though the studio interfered a lot of things and made him do things that maybe he wouldn't have necessarily done, I think it's all ends up there, like we said, on the screen, and it's a solid, you wouldn't expect a sequel to Phantasm to be any great shakes, but this is a solid little movie.
I'm kind of pumped for 3 and 4.
Yeah, like I said, I am as well. It's I think I'm in the same boat as you are, Sean, that I don't think I've seen all of 3 and 4. I know I've seen bits of them, but after watching 1 and 2, I'm excited for 3 and 4 and hopefully Ravager sometime this next year. I'm really hoping, or 2015, I should say.
Yeah, I loved the first one. This one was a nice follow-up. I know 3 and 4 are going to set up a lot more. I'm going to be liking that they get the actual Michael to come back. James LaGrosse felt a little out of place. He didn't have the same sort of feel, the same sort of companionship they did with Reggie. But overall, this was a good sequel. And I'm glad that, I think the fact that Coscarelli's done all these films gives it a nice narrative through line that that we kind of miss in the Friday the 13th
because
it's passed off to director and whatever.
Yeah.
Most movies like that are like that. What I like, this is my second viewing of it, and I liked it a lot more than my first, which tells me this is going to be one of those movies that bears up to repeated viewings,
does.
Like the original Phantasm. So I'm looking forward to watching this one again, like a year or two down the line, and seeing what else I pick up out of it, especially after seeing, you know, whatever is added in 3 and 4. Yep. So I'm really excited right now, actually.
Yeah. There's a lot coming, and there's, I mean, it's, like I said, it's tight continuity, and I mean, eventually we get to the point in these where Coscarelli uses unused footage from the first one to tie stuff back in. Like, it's that deep.
And it works?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I can't wait.
Oh, yeah. There is vintage 70s footage, number 4, I believe.
Ooh.
That's not, that had never been seen.
You know, it's funny, because that usually sounds like the sign of it going downhill. You know what I mean? Using recycled footage, but it's not recycled though.
It's new. It's just, it hadn't been used.
It's vintage footage.
Yeah.
It's vintage. And it's,
so basically, yeah, we're just going to see a lot of Harry Bush. That's.
No.
Okay.
Speak for yourself.
If you listen to this month's Star Trek Monthly Monday, you know that's okay with me.
Hey, yeah. Honestly, with me, I don't care. It's just going to have the 3 W's: warm, wet, and willing. That's the only thing that matters. Did I really just say that?
What about woman? You didn't mention that.
Oh. That goes without saying. Fine, 4 W's.
Oh.
Which I've amended from when I was a younger person. It was very simple: 2 legs and breathing. But. All right, I've totally derailed us.
Yeah,
the last time you talked to him was on a phone through a pane of glass, too.
Oh well, you know, just and you know, I don't know. I guess if just you know, if listeners, if Heroes ministrations are getting, just keep remembering, it's only a dream.
No,
or is it?
No, it's not.
If you shop at Amazon.com, please consider using the link at 2TrueFreaks.com to shop there. If you use this link to go to Amazon and then you shop, 2 True Freaks gets a little cut of what you buy, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. So you get to shop as usual and help out the 2 True Freaks at the same time.
Visit our website at 2TrueFreaks.com. 2 True Freaks is always spelled T-W-O. T-R-U-E-F-R-E-A-K-S.
You can email 2 True Freaks directly at 2TrueFreaks@gmail.com.
2 True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search 2 True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find 2 True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for 2 True Freaks. If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about 2 True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of 2 True Freaks.
Sock it to me.